All right, we've enjoyed our Christmas vacation. We're back to normal. The last lesson we talked about stripping away the folklore, the romanticism that attends a Christmas story or the nativity. And I want to remind you that our personal connection to the events of Christmas, the born-again kind, our personal connection is that we have come to know that divine Christ, that one that was in the baby, that was a baby in the manger. We know him personally. And he's the one who died for our sins and raised again to his glory. Now, we know that's fact, but just think about the reality of that truth, that that baby that they came to see, we personally know. Just like I know you, I know him, and you do too. Okay, while we have come to know him intimately, the person born that night, we have many questions about the people who came to see the Christ child in Bethlehem. We have two groups of pilgrims who make their way to see him. Last time we learned that the shepherds found the child who, as Levitical priests, approved this lamb, which they did for all the sacrificial lambs. On that night, they were called in to examine the Lamb of God and prove him for sacrifice. Although this may not be what may not have been fully understood by them, we understand it. The second group of pilgrims we are going to look at are total strangers, the so-called wise men or the magi. If the shepherds needed a biblical rehabilitation, we can say the same thing about the wise men. To begin with, the event of the wise men happened a couple of years later, not on the night of the birth of Jesus, as our pageants used to show. Secondly, the place where the family or of Jesus was is not in a temporary birthing station for the lambs, but a more appropriate place for a family. It is apparent from the text that the family did not go back to Nazareth. It is only speculation, but did they intend to move to Bethlehem all along? I think perhaps, because Bethlehem was the home of their ancestry, and they all went there to register in their own cities, Luke 2:3 says. We also speculate that Joseph intended to stay in Bethlehem for an extended time, and I might suggest that Micah 2, knowing who he was in the family and who the baby Jesus was, and that it was to be born in Bethlehem, he may well have thought we need to live there. So was Micah 2 the reason to stay? It is possible they wanted to be closer to the family. This is their ancestral home. Support for a permanent Bethlehem home is that, after leaving Egypt, he was going to go back there, but he was warned not to go there, so returned to Nazareth. So where is home? Well, supposing Mary's family lived in Nazareth, I'm supposing that because that's where they call met. I'm not sure if that's the right word here because these sometimes were arranged marriages. But anyway, they were in Nazareth. I'm supposing that somebody, maybe her family, lived there. Certainly he was there. So it's possible then that if Mary's family lived in Nazareth, that Joseph's family lived in Bethlehem, which would follow the male line, why he wanted to go back there and live there. Fulfill prophecy. That was what the Bible said he should do. Some of the details remain a mystery, but that the family intended to remain in Bethlehem as a semi-permanent home is supported by the text, because the angel said, don't go there, go to Nazareth. So we have figured out the real story of the shepherds, but what about the real story of the wise men? And I say it has its challenges, and you may not agree with my conclusions, but this is America, and we are free. The text is so brief that one must conclude that the questions we have in the 21st century would have had answers in the first for the people that wrote it and read it. So the text about the wise men, the only biblical source of information, is in Matthew chapter 2, starting in verse 1. Now after Jesus was born in Bethlehem of Judea in the days of Herod the king, magi from the east arrived in Jerusalem. Break off there. I'm not going to spend a lot of time on a lot of details, but the wise men are the magi, they're the soothsayers, they're the dream tellers, they're interpreters. They were members of the present Persian Parthian priestly caste, originally one of the tribes of the Medes, which is to the east, to your right. That's what's difficult about this last little bit, about knowing all what happened to the east of that seam, I call it, which is kind of listed there. So our folklore and traditions, the Magi, the wise men, are the three kings, Now, for those that read the Bible allegorically, this is fine. We don't. But notice how this comes into our culture. In fact, we have some papier-mâché wise men I'm going to bring this morning and park them in front of you to show you exactly the same thing I'm going to show you here. In keeping with allegorical interpretation, the three wise men all represent humanity in the persons of the sons of Noah. Did you know that? You ever notice that they have different color skins? Like these guys do? In fact, Rubens, the great Jewish painter, even has them named. Well, he didn't name them, but tradition has them named. Son of Ham and Belshazzar, Shem, Jaspar, Japheth, Melchior, however you say that name. So these are the three wise men. They basically, I guess, in a sense, represent the Gentiles and the Jews. I mean, represents humanity. Back so well entrenched is this folklore, John MacArthur says, that in their three skulls, amazingly enough, are said to have been found. Yes, they are found in the 12th century by Bishop Reinhold of Cologne. The bishop dug those up and knew right off they were the skulls because their eyes were still in the sockets fixed towards Bethlehem. Today, believe it or not, friends, they are in an exhibit in a priceless casket in the Great Cathedral of Europe at Cologne. And we were there in 2012, and here's a picture of the outside. And there's a picture of the inside after everybody is dismissed. We were there on a Sunday morning. And I can't remember whether I did this intentionally. I must have, because I did focus a little bit on this casket clear in the back, at the back of the altar. And it's been sitting there ever since 1161. Now, think about old. That's getting ancient. A little closer up of it, and it is a priceless gold laden box that supposedly has the skull of these three wise men. And you see a little closer. Anyway, the wise men's skulls are there. Now, back to reality. I mean, it's amazing. The Catholic Church has these relics, and they go back from the date. They date back to Constantine, supposedly. When Helena, his mother, went around the world looking for places to recognize, like the Church of the Holy Sepulchre and so forth. And so from that period of time on, we have these things, because Christianity now became a blessed religion. And if it's going to be our blessed religion, we need to know about these sites. So Helena goes back to the Holy Land and finds these things. So some of them are, all of them are probably pretty much built on fabric that's got a lot of holes in it. Okay. Now, we do not know much about the backgrounds. I'm talking about geopolitical backgrounds here. And we got to also say, but what is there is all we need. I'm not criticizing the text here. I'm criticizing our lack of understanding of it. We know how the nations of the world are aligned. We do in our life. We just, in fact, had this, Larry just went through some of that this morning, how the nations of the world are aligned and how that alignment might affect our life or our future. The Jews would, too, have been acutely aware of the nations and kings around them, and because of the treatment around that they were received by at their hands. So we live in the United States relatively securely, but they did not. They were living on the very seam of the two world-class empires, the Romans to the west, the Parthia Persians to the northeast. And that's my shaded line there. Now, so many things to say, but it's always interesting what God does. He puts Israel exactly where the trouble is. And I said, why does he do that? Why did he put it over to some safe place? Well, what good are they in a safe place? So they're put in a place where God deals with them and deals with the world around them, and it's incredible. You know, it's a land bridge between three continents. And so we have the Roman Empire expanding, and it gets to the point where we have the star, Israel, and then it sort of like hits the desert. And then we have what we call Eastern or Asia. And these two don't mix very well. So we have the Persian Parthian or Iran. We have the Parthian Empire, you see in the dark green, is at the time of Christ's birth, is quite extensive. It covers all those places we just mentioned, Iraq, even parts of Syria, so forth, clear over to the Indus River in the east. So Parthian ancient kingdom was south and east, south and east, whatever I'm trying to say here, kind of wraps around, because the desert's right to the east, so you got to kind of go around it. From the time of 250 to 320 BC, now that's after Alexander the Great. This is now in the Persian Empire period. And that's why I put the dates up here. So, see, Greece took over 322, so this is after 322, and then Greece only lasted 11 years, and then Rome sort of have this back and forth, which is what you see on the other side. We have the Seleucids, the Parthians, Ptolemy's world. That's a very, very confusing period, you know, between Greece and Rome, because they go back and forth. Anyway, the going back and forth is always through the land of Israel. Always through the land of Israel. They're right on the edge. Now, one thing you may not know, interesting, that the Kurds are a lot in the news, have been a lot in the news, because there have been tries, there have been attempts to annihilate them with poison gas, with Saddam Hussein. So you see them in the north, and these are the Medes, what's left of them, you might say. These are the Medes that we're talking about. These are the people that produced these magi. Okay. Now, the nations of the world, if you take Revelation as giving all eight of them, go from Egypt, Syria, Babylon, which is the time of Daniel, and in Daniel's lifetime, at the end of his life, Persia, Cyrus the Great, takes over. That's 539 to 37 in that period of time. Don't know how long Daniel lived, but I think 537 is the date that they usually considered Persia. Then we have Greece, then we have the mix-up, and then we come to Rome. And these are given in a figure that Daniel sees. Daniel doesn't see, but Daniel interprets for Nebuchadnezzar this gold, silver, bronze, iron history that for them is still future. And then the stone that will come and crush all of these at the end, which is the Messiah. I'm going to skip this because it probably won't help any. Okay, now we have Herod in Jerusalem. It says in Matthew 2:1, now after Jesus was born in Bethlehem, Judea, in the days of Herod the king, magi from the east arrived in Jerusalem, saying, where is he who is born king of the Jews? For we have seen his star in the east and come to worship him. When Herod the king heard this, he was troubled, and all Jerusalem with him. I suppose all Jerusalem of anybody that had any authority. Now Herod, the king, Herod the Great, became king about 20 BC. Now we're about 4 BC, depending on what you want to take here. So he's been king for 14 years and has done marvelous things in terms of building. He worked hard, risked his life, went to Rome, and got approval to be the king of the Jews. So he sits as Herod, king of the Jews. It's a fake, was it false news we have today? Well, we had a fake king. His wife was Jewish, who he killed. You know, wish he wouldn't have, but he did. And he never was a Jew. He was an Adamean, so he'd be kind of like from Esau, that family. All right, so Herod worked hard. Why you want to be the king of the Jews, I don't know. But Herod worked hard, risked his life to become king of the Jews. The question is taken, where is the king of the Jews? This question is taken as a great threat to his future. Notwithstanding the fact that he is old and ill and advancing his age, not long for the earth, but he is still fighting for his kingdom. He'll die within a year or two. Now, it says that Jesus was born in Bethlehem. We have magi from the east. They've come to worship him. There's a lot of history here, and that's part of what this is. A lot of history here. So briefly, the magi came from the Medes. Now, the Medes, they don't disappear. Even though you might say, well, it's the Assyrian Empire, it's a Babylon Empire, it's a Persian Empire. The Medes are always there. And so like they are there today, they're still there. All right, so it's this group that produced this, what's called a hereditary group of soothsayers. Okay, the Medes did not disappear because they were invaded or subdued, but maintained their identity as they do today. And we know them as the Kurds. Now, the Magi, fortune-telling is a good trait if you're good at it. Fatal if you're not. Every king wants to know the future. It is a matter of life and death for his reign or dynasty. He thus is mindful to take care of the fortune-teller since they could be his lifeline for the future. The Medes have a long history of dream interpretation, of a dream interpreter's class, a hereditary class. Now, when I talk about hereditary class, I mean, it's like a family. The family produces the children, and that the knowledge that's contained in this class is timeless. I mean, it doesn't go with the generation. You know, my grandfather came up with something. It's still true, and I carry that on to my grandchildren. So that's what I say, hereditary class. So the dreams that they had, the predictions that were made, they sometimes would obviously, we'll see here with Daniel, they were covered centuries of time. But that doesn't mean they give up on it. They still hold to it. It's true. All right. So the Medes have a long history of the dream interpreters class, a hereditary class. Dreams are considered messages from the gods, and we would say capital G in Daniel's case, that warned about things to come. Knowing the future always provides an advantage over the adversary. For that reason, the Magi were protected class until the prediction was false, usually ending their life. So I want to point out to you that we have the Medo-Syria, the Medo-Babylonian, the Persia again. And so we have all these, the Medes are always there. So when we get to our story, the Medes are still there. And they're the ones that produce these Magi. In fact, you have this bas-relief carving of the Magi, or these guys. And some of them are Iranian, and some of them are, I should say Persian, and some of them are Medes. And you can tell that by the hats. The rounded hats are the Medes, the square hats are the Persians. And they're obviously mixed together. You know, it wasn't like they're distinct, but they are distinct within the group. All right, so I'll go to Daniel. Daniel is taken as a young boy from Jerusalem over the Fertile Crescent to Babylon. Nebuchadnezzar takes him, puts him in a specially trained group of young boys to serve the king. And again, we'll just know, you know this, there's some of the sons of Daniel, sons of Israel, serving the king's court. Verse 6, now among them from the sons of Judah were Daniel and his three other brothers, or sons, friends, there we go. As for these four youths, it says that Daniel even understood all kinds of visions and dreams, and it goes down lower, it says, for they entered the king's personal service. As for every matter of wisdom and understanding about which the king consulted them, he found them 10 times better than the magicians and the conjurers. So he stood up above them, and we know by the title it's given Daniel, he becomes the chief of these magi. Now, because of the supernatural gift of dream interpretation, Daniel rises to the top. The point is that over 500 years before the Magi will come to the east, from the east, to see the Christ child, it's been 500 years before they come to see the Christ child in Bethlehem. It's not a great reach to believe that with the combination of Daniel's giftedness, his personal stature in the eyes of kings, he served two empires, Medes and the Babylonians and the Persians, that the writings of Daniel would have had credibility in the eyes of all the successors on the throne. Remember, this isn't something that just goes away because somebody died. The information stays put. Because these predictions are made sometimes, as we'll see with Daniel, for over a 500-year period. Actually longer. Predictions of the image of the metals can be traced to the days of the Messiah's future, validating the chief magi's Daniel writing. Now think about it. In the days of Jesus, those four metals that appear in the image that Nebuchadnezzar see, that Daniel interprets, are all history. They're all history by that time. The gold is gone, the silver is gone, the bronze is gone, and the iron is in place. The Romans are in place. So we have these pictures. We know about that. And the last thing that happens in this stone picture is the stone that's cut, that is not cut with hands, breaks the image, smashes all the kingdoms before. Now, when the Magi came to see the baby Jesus, they said that they had seen his star while in the east and followed it. So we asked a question. How did the Magi know about the star? Well, it was not written in Daniel, but it is in Numbers 24:17. And there it says, I see him, but not now. I behold him, but not near. A star shall come from Jacob, a scepter shall rise from Israel. That's Numbers 24:17. Now that is, at this point, is a 1,500-year-old prophecy. And they're still waiting for its fulfillment. So they knew, they could have known about it. So the question, did they have a copy of Numbers? Well, remember the diaspora, the deportation of the Jews, sent them to Babylon, and with them they brought the scriptures. Besides Daniel, there were a lot of them that came. And Daniel would have certainly been, I can't say he walked in with a copy of the scriptures, but whenever they were, he would have been of the godly line and would have recognized the scripture. And the Jews had them, but wouldn't have left them behind. So they probably had somehow access to Numbers. Else, how would they know about the star? Now, in 4 BC, there were many Jews still in Babylon in the territory we call Parthia, and they had access to the Jewish scriptures. Well, then why did they ask where the king is to be born, which is recorded in Micah 5:2? Did they just miss that one? Did they not have the copy of Micah if they had Numbers? Or were they just confirming what they were reading with Herod? In other words, they knew it was Bethlehem, thinking it was Bethlehem, but they weren't sure. Comparing notes, but that's ask Herod, and he says the same thing. So it can, that's a possibility. I'm not sure that's a good one, but it's a possibility. Because they went to Jerusalem, they knew that, because they followed the star. They also understood something about, if they got from Numbers, that this is a Jewish star, and they need to get to Jerusalem to find out about it. Now, the diaspora is here. This is the first century Christians. You see, they are scattered all over the world, and we're looking here at Edom, that's Assyria. And we have Media over here in Mesopotamia and so forth. So the Parthian Empire is what we call it, what was the old Persian Empire. Now Herod the Great is fearful that a real king of Israel will show up. Perhaps he is aware of the Davidic covenant. Again, he tries to be a Jew that promised the son of David, that he promised that a son of David will reign. We know that he is ruthless in his acts and will stop at nothing that would threaten his reign. It was said that it was safer to be Herod's pig than to be his son or his wife. The Magi were coming with an understanding of history and prophecy, I believe. They collectively have watched the head of gold disappear, the chest of silver melt away, the torso of bronze give away now to the legs of iron, 63 BC, and they were again challenged and took it back in 37 AD when Herod the Great took it. Or Romans took it then. They're also aware that another king is coming. They are aware, the wise men are aware, that another king is coming that will shatter the remains of the former empires by a crushing force. Now, I'm saying they knew this, and these prophecies, we always think, well, those are for us in the last days. Why do we think that, why do we have the hubris? Why do we think only for us? Why did those guys not understand this prophecy for their time, because it already was history for them? So if they come in and saying these nations have disappeared, and the last thing that's going to happen is that there's going to be a stone that's going to crush all the former nations, I would think they got their attention. So if you go on in Daniel 2, it says, verse 34, in the image interpretation, and you continued looking until the stone was cut out without hands and struck the statue of the feet of iron clay and crushed them. Verse at the bottom, but the stone that struck the statue became a great mountain to fill the whole earth. Now again, be a Magi guy. Think you know this, and the last thing that's going to happen, there's going to be a king come that's going to smash them all. Now if you want to get on the right side of history, what are you going to do? Go find where this king is. For the Magi, there was no mystery in these sayings. The stone was the coming king. They would have understood Daniel's interpretation that the idea of a coming king was preserved in the knowledge of the Magi by hereditary association. So when the nations had run their course, the last one now was in place, Rome, then they saw a star, the coming of the Jewish king. They followed it. They came to the capital of that nation and inquired where the king of the Jews had been born. The so-called Gentile kingmakers, the Magi, had no problem with the Jewish king as a world king. Now, there's a little bit of background here we don't have time to go into, but the Persians were in a very, very difficult period right then, and they were looking for a king. So that could have factored in this too. They might have said, well, that's the fulfillment of everything. There's a vacancy in the role of king in our nation. We're going to go find the king. Yeah, he's the king of the nation. Obviously, that's what it is intended to be, that little stone that was cut out without hands. So they came, or they had come, with the full assurance that prophecy was being fulfilled before their eyes. So sure were they that before they left Babylon, they brought valuable king-class gifts listed as gold, frankincense, and myrrh. And these are appropriate for a king. Again, here they came with an entourage, not with three camels leisurely crossing in the desert. They came with much more of a presence. So by the way, Herod did not react to these guys coming. If it was a big entourage with military protection, Herod was, at this time, he had no ability to defend an intrusion. So he could have seen these guys actually coming in to take over. But he had no force to do that. Well, obviously they weren't going to do that. But you can understand why if there was such a big group, why didn't Herod react? Well, he couldn't. All right? All right. Okay, notice, now these are back to the Magi. Notice they did not ask for confirmation from anyone that we know of. Before they left from the east, they were convinced that the king had arrived in Judea. They were convinced. I mean, four nations and the star convinced them. They brought their gold and their frankincense and myrrh. What is surprising to us is their desire to be among the first to pay homage and obedience to the new world king. Well, they must have rejoiced on the way back to find confirmation in a dream on the return home. So everything they thought about that was true in their visit was confirmed when the angel says to them in their dream, do not go back to Herod. That's a confirmation that they were on the right track. And they go home and said, rejoicing. So they hadn't made a mistake. They didn't make an assumption that was wrong. They're right on track. As the Magi returned, they must have waited for a worldwide announcement. Can you think now to go back? Okay, we've seen it. Now let's just wait for it to happen. That is when the king would come into prominence and be crowned. That was the next event, right? They saw the birth. Now babies can be crowned. You know, they're not going to wait till they're adult. They waited, and I might say, and they waited, and they waited, and they waited. Remember, the Magi were hereditary, so these guys could have been old. They could have died off in 10 years, but still the next group would have waited. So they acted more like the think group, or group think, than as individuals, I say. These Magi may have died, but the hope of the prophecy continued regardless of the people, whether they were dead or alive. But no worldwide empire of the Jews came about, nor ever since. And I just mentioned here, the wise men still wait for him. But still today, he doesn't come. Now, the sad reality is, as John records for us in chapter 1, verse 11, he came to his own, and those who were his own did not receive him. That's the bad news. So truth is stranger than fiction, as they say. The Jews from whom Jesus came, for whom he was promised, was found rejected as their king against insurmountable evidence. Yet the Gentiles, who were included only tangentially, only had the word of God from Daniel, they made a full-hearted commitment to the king. You see the difference? Wow. The Jews had all these reasons to believe that that's the king. All the Gentiles had was the word of Daniel, which was the word of God. So the Gentiles were represented by the visiting Magi are ready to receive him. But the Jews denied the king his throne, but crucified him, saying, and it's almost hard to say, we have no king but Caesar. Well, eventually, even the Magi lost hope in coming Messiah. If you go over there today, no one's thinking that. All kinds of strange religions, on the other hand, have originated from Babylon. Many are likely corrupted versions of Judaism. After all, that was the perfect religion up till that point. God revealed religion. Now, finally, in the 7th century AD, the Islamic hordes, the people of Abraham's folly, have perpetrated a false religion on the people of the East, including the Persians and the Medes and the Syrians and everybody else that they can reach. And I hear they're still trying to force it down people's throats by running trucks into crowds. This is that group. Of course, we can never assume a different outcome than what the sovereign God has determined. But it is interesting to speculate what would have happened to these people of the world had the Jews adopted the King of Kings as the Magi did. And that's the end of it. I think it's amazing to me. Here we have Gentiles. And some of these things I said, no, I don't, Don, this is not right. Then I go back to what the Bible said. These Magi were Gentiles. They had no reason to do this. Unless they knew something. They said, well, where did they get the knowledge from? Well, we got to go back to Babylon. Where was Daniel? Babylon. Was he a Magi? Yes, he was. So we have all this, and they say, well, Babylon Empire to the Persian Empire, to the Greek Empire, would they have done that? I don't know why not. Because in the lifetime of Daniel, we see two. you know, go from Babylon to Persia. That was, you know, in a matter of a couple of years in one lifetime. So then you had to wait till next one, which is Greece. So anyway, all these things I think are there, and I think that strips away some of the mystery behind these guys that come, and I really become admiring of them and their faith. They were not misguided. These Magi were not misguided. They came, and I think came way with saving faith. Maybe they had saving faith before they came, because they believed what the Bible said. They just wanted to go see it for themselves and to pay homage. All right. Anything you want to add or subtract? Got a minute or two?